Hello, I'm James Cameron. I'm the project leader for PPTP and NetTrek, the computer game. I'm into software engineering, like that's been my job for 22 years or so. I started with VMS in 1981 and got into Unix in about 83. Got into Linux at about 2.0.36. In 1999 I went bush to a wonderful place called Turuena, which has a population of 76. It's 6 hours inland from Sydney, but I still work for HP. I'm the Linux backline specialist for the Asia Pacific, which means all the other guys take the calls, and then when they can't figure it out, they pass it on to me. I also do Unix and VMS support still. So what am I here for today? I'm here to get you excited about my hobby. My hobby is microcontrollers, and specifically PIC microcontrollers, because I haven't had time to look at all the others yet. I want to share my excitement in my hobby. I want to also point out how Linux has helped in the world domination market. Linux and the open source model has extended into this field as well, and is helping the hobby get extended into places where it wouldn't normally be. I'm also going to try and say how it's fun, why you'd want to get into it. Things like making really small gadgets can be sort of cool. It's also cool because there's some skills required, and it's a very reachable hobby. It's not that expensive, and it's not that difficult to get something actually going. What I'd like you to take away from this is that maybe next time you've got a spare couple of days that you're not coding anything, you could get, just try it. Get the right bits and pieces, plug all the things in, see if you can make your bike light on the back of your bike link your email address in Morse code or something like that. I haven't heard it done yet. I thought that one up. So what is a PIC microcontroller? Well, it's a self-contained computer. It's very small. For example, here's one right here. Sits on your finger. This one's dead, which is why I'm happy to just zap it like that. It's got its own memory. It hasn't got a bus necessarily, and it's all basically everything in there. It's not very powerful though, but it can do things like flash lights and turn lights on and off, and it can talk RS-232 and that sort of stuff. It's closed source silicon, so unfortunately, you know, it's not open source inside and you can't really get into it that much, but at least the instructions are well documented. The manufacturer is Microchip, and they give away their free development tools for Windows, and we've got lots of nice tools now on Linux as well. The size varies from this little thing, which is an 8-pin one, to the somewhat larger ones, which are 40-pin. I've got a few over there. The package type, they're not all necessarily that little thing with legs that you see. Sometimes the legs come out sideways instead. But it performs well for the price. I mean, these little things are only, $4 or $5, and you can get it to do things. That's the sort of retail price you get. They're very fast. They don't take much power. They're a RISC chip, in case you're familiar with microprocessors in general. This one only has 35 instructions or so, and they're easy to learn. It only has one accumulator. It's a Harvard architecture, which means that the data and the code are in separate memories and they don't touch, which is great because you can never have a stack overflow. But it doesn't run Linux on the chip, sorry. So many to choose from. They're my favourites. I think there's something like 50 different models. Someone can correct me if they know. They're the ones that I use in particular. As I said, they range in size. that the pins row is how many connections you can make to them. Code space is how many bytes of memory they have. Like the biggest one, there's only 8K of program memory. And that's okay, programs are small on this sort of stuff. The amount of RAM they have, volatile data, well, 41 bytes for that little one there. Can't do much in them. Non-volatile, how much EEPROM they have for storing data, that ranges as well. They're generally quite flexible in what sort of power they'll take, as long as it's stable. And as you can see, the prices are quite interesting. They're the retail prices from some suppliers in Australia and America. They're Australian dollars. So there's a picture of the smallest one that I use. That happens to be one where the quartz circle on it lets you erase it. This is a picture of one which doesn't need ultraviolet to be erased. You can just reprogram it at any time. This is the really big 40-pin one. I didn't gimp that. The camera just did that nice sort of sparkle there. So this is the internal architectural diagram of the biggest chip. You can see up in the top left corner we have the flash program memory where the program is stored. The data lives over here in the RAM file registers, so that's your data memory. The program counter in between them points at the program memory, so the instructions pipe down into the instruction register, they get decoded down there somewhere. The arithmetic and logic unit, where all the mathematics takes place, is there. And out here are all the real-world pins where you connect devices to, like LEDs. I don't know a way of doing that, sorry. That's horizontal maneuvering. That better? Okay, now you can't see what you're doing there. So, right, okay. Well, anyway, the few things I want to point out there are all those output pins out there. Each one of them can either be on or off. They can either be inputs or outputs. Some of them can be analog inputs, so you can sense the voltages. A couple of them are specifically made for serial data, these two down here. A few of them are made for interfacing to other serial devices like I2C bus and stuff like that. Before I get on to, I'll just bring the lights back up again. Right. Hey. Fun this. Yeah, no, it's much too complicated. It's a nice LCD screen. Just a warning about safety. If you haven't actually done any electronics, I've got lots of nice stories that I can tell you afterwards. But yeah, wear the safety glasses because things do explode in your face occasionally. I've had tips of LED in my cheek, that sort of thing. Test some simple things. I once had a laptop which the power supply was plugged into the power board, but somehow the programming kit on top was at 110 volts relative to everything else in the room. And why? Well, it turned out the earth pin in the power board had broken. And so the power supply naturally wanted to float up either side of 240 or something. It was wonderful. So that was my warning on safety. So I like to say such things. Development process and tool set. What I'm going to do is describe the sequence that you go through if you want to make a device. Firstly, you work out what you want it to do, like flash a light randomly, for instance. Then you build the circuit, which is a matter of, well, if you're into that sort of thing, you can either plug things into things or you can make a circuit board and solder things up or wire wrap them and all that sort of thing. then you go to your Linux box and type in all the code and work out how to make it go and maybe run it in a simulator and that sort of stuff. Then you get one of these device programmers and you plug it into your serial port or your parallel port or whatever it's meant to go, and you put the chip in the programmer and you tell the Linux laptop to go and program the chip, and then you take the chip out of that and then you put it in the circuit you actually want it to run in. That's the distribution phase of software development. And then you turn the power on and off it goes. Well, usually it doesn't, but tools that are used in design, you know, the good old Vi and Emacs or Vi. I use Numeric and Xthread for doing all the calculations, component values and stuff like that. For doing schematics and circuits, I use paper and Xcircuit mainly. Xcircuit is quite interesting in that it's sort of Vi-like. Every key does something. And you can sort of bump into a key and find out what it does. It's slow to learn, but it's fast to use. I've found that much easier to use than Dia, for example. But then again, Dia seems to be made more for a sort of consumer market, or, you know, you've got to be able to point at something and select it before you move it, that sort of thing. And that's not the problem with Xcircuit. You just sort of move the mouse while pressing keys and things happen. GNU EDA, I haven't really got into it. I had a look at it a long time ago and it didn't seem to do anything for me, but I've heard that it does now. Now, when you're writing and building the source code, which is written in assembly language or something else, I'd be using Emacs, and then GPASM is the assembler, which then writes out a hex file which contains the binary code which gets put in the programmer. Other people have been trying out SDCC, the Small Device C Compiler. It has PicSource being developed. Then there's PicForth, which is the fourth implementation on Pic. It needs an old version of GForth, which you can find in Debian. The adherents to that are on a mailing list. There's one called GNU Pic. I'll mention that later. Of course, you use Make, apart from the obvious, but you can also use Make for actually doing the burning phase. So you put the chip in and you type Make Burn, and it will have, you put it in the Make file for the fact that you want it to run the burner. And GPSim, which is a GTK plus GUI application for simulating the PIC. And on a reasonable computer, it can simulate the PIC faster than the PIC can run. Oh yeah, the PICs range in clock speeds. I think the fastest is something like 20 or 40 megahertz, which isn't terribly fast, but hey, they don't do much. And so, yeah, no operating system to slow you down. The chips can even run all the way down to DC, which means you can clock them at one clock cycle a year if you wanted to. So when you're doing the device programming side of things, which is where you're taking the hex file, the compiled data, and you're putting it into the chip, PicProg is one I use most. It's written by a bloke called Brian Lane. It's a cursors-based application. It attaches to the programmer via the parallel port, and every time the kernel interface changed for how to fiddle with your parallel port, they ended up having to change that as well. So at the moment, for those interested, it uses the IOPerm and OutB and IMB instructions. Then there's PROG84, which is mainly a command line one. There's no cursors interface or anything. Again, it's parallel port, and it accesses to the parallel port differently. It's really curious. It uses open of slash dev slash port, and then seeks the right port and then writes to it. Odyssey is a new one. It's come out, the release came out in the last three or four weeks. It's interesting in that it supports lots of different interfaces. So the guys who are pushing that project seem to be wanting to be everything to everybody. So leading on to the device programmers, the things that you actually plug in, I'll give you a few pictures rather than you'll pile off down the front. Here's one which comes from a guy in Hong Kong who makes kits. It's this one, this little one here. This one, you can see on the picture, you plug the pick into the middle bit. You can, of course, buy the lever thing which lets you put the chip in without stuffing it with leads every time. It runs off 24 volts or something, so it can get its programming voltage, and it hooks to the parallel port. Then there's the bigger one, which can take bigger chips. In this case, I've got it configured for small chips and medium-sized chips. Excuse the fly up the top on the connector. And there's another fly off to the right-hand side of that one. It was a particularly fly day. I live out in the country and, you know, flies are everywhere. This one is from a UK company, and he also got serial EEPROM support. So you can plug in serial EEPROMs down here and program them. Like EEPROMs on the PCI cards and that sort of stuff. This is what I actually do it through the PCI card. This one I had a lot of fun with because I was asked to add Linux support for the programming of serial EEPROMs to Project ID4. Then the big sort. This is a kit from Dontronics in Melbourne. In this one, there's a parallel port interface off to the left, which is where the programming signals originate. And for when you start running it, well, there's a run load switch in the middle there, and when you start running it, you can even connect the serial port to your PIC, so your PIC can then save things through the serial port. Yes? No? Dontronics.com, though, and just look up the model number. Approximately, all right. That is a bare kit with the parts for something like $20 or $30. It wasn't huge. There's not much on them. These particular ones just have a simple interface chip. There's no brains on them. All the brains are in your laptop in the program which does the programming. Oh yeah, you can get really beautiful ones that've got a little microcontroller on them, which hands off all the job of doing the programming to the microcontroller, which is great if you're worried about that sort of stuff, but most of us aren't. The specification pages for the processors say that you've got to program the things in a certain order, and you've got to, you know, send clock signals at the right speed and all that, but it's such a wide range in the specification that, hey, I use a 486. Works fine. And I've used a faster computer, it also works fine. But I like using computers which aren't important to me in case I do anything really weird with the power and the parallel port, because I've heard of people who just lost their parallel port. And on some laptops, you know, the parallel port is somewhat close to everything else. It's not just a card you can pull out. So that's your laptop gone. So I use a 486 for that. Now, communities, places you can go to for help. And these are really what got me involved in this. There are lots of people out there who love to share information and tell you when you're wrong, you know, that sort of thing. PicList is the biggest. It's a very high volume list. If you've ever been on Debian Devel, you'll know sort of the sort of volume you might get from PicList. One or 200 messages a day, depending on whether it's a public holiday in the US. Subject line policing is enforced, such that if you say something without the right tag on the subject line, you'll get the moderators jumping on you and saying, post it again. Lots of other stuff is discussed in that list as well. So just general electrical engineering, off-topic stuff. They'll even talk about Linux if you let them. GNUPIC is a lower volume mailing list. Similar current coverage in terms of subject area, but the proponents on this list are all open sources, where this, the pick list guys are quite a lot of proprietary guys who want to make money from their designs and often can't help you because they can't tell you how they did something. They'll sort of mutter about it and then say, sorry, but I can't tell you. And there's the electronic IRC channel on the Freenode network, where we talk about picks and other stuff. We've got a wiki as well where we put cool places to get free samples and that sort of thing. So that's the end of the description of the tools and the communities where you can go for help and the whole introduction to the hobby. And now my plan is to actually go and describe the projects that I've done over the last 4 or 5 years. So has anyone got any questions on, you know, the architecture of the tools or anything like that? Yes. For programming, yes, you need to plug a power supply in, mainly because the computers aren't going to generate the 13 volts you need for some of the older chips. But for some of them, no, you can actually use a low voltage programming mode where they only need 5 volts and you can probably pinch that off something if you really want to be dodgy about it. $8, $15, $25, that's the per unit pricing retail in Australia. If you want them in thousands, you get them for a lot less. Suppliers such as DigiKey in the US, the ones that I've used to get large batches of them. Yeah, you can find them on eBay really cheap if you don't know where they've been. No, I mean, I've heard of people getting chips and they've been all, you know, crushed up into that. I wouldn't salvage them because the mass-produced devices that use them, they don't use reprogrammable chips. They use one-time programmable chips. Unless you want to get something and file off the top and expose it to UV or X-ray, it's not really worth it. No, I don't know. I mean, Sony PlayStation mod chips, for example, are picked. You had a question? Well, they need to run off a bit of power. Some of those things over there will just run off a 9-volt battery just like that for, say, 2 or 3 days. The temperature sensor design I have runs by pulling power off the serial port, just using the DCR signal. Some of them do, some of them don't. My temperature sensor kit, for example, uses an internal oscillator, but some of the other ones have got crystals attached to them. So just to get the simple chip going, you need power, usually a crystal and a couple of capacitors, but it can run on its own internal one, and then whatever else you want to attach to it. So the amount of baggage that you need to get one going is very, very small. Yes. No. I don't do my own PCBs. My wife is very much against the chemical process involved. And I haven't used the other tools for making PCBs like Eagle. It's in Debian, it's non-free. Sure. Cutting the copper with the drill thing that goes wandering around and cuts it off. Okay, that's unsubmitted by me. Any other questions? Huh. Yeah? bigger than I want. Okay, thanks, Mike. Any other burning questions? How do they compare to the microchipped MP lab? Well, you can't get the source for the microchipped MP lab, so there are occasional little things that crop up in that, and you know, it doesn't work too well or something, and then a new release comes out. Microchips do release new versions fairly frequently because it's in their interest, because they want to sell the chips. Well, for a three or two line LCD, the people who now sell the kits, like Domtronics and Kits R Us and a few others who I don't get any feedback from, they sell the LCD panels as well. So if you come down afterwards, the LCD panels on some of these kits, they're from those sources. I think I'd better get on. Yeah? Yeah, I mean, there's also a big smith. So. Yeah, they're very easy to get hold of. Last one. Well, I better move on because I've got to finish by 1:45. Is that right? Right, thanks, Carol. So I'm going to go through some of my projects, and on each project I'll try and give you a picture if we've got one available. I'll maybe even show the schematic of some of them. I'll say what it does and maybe say what I learned from it. Just as a comment, some of my inspiration came from work that I did for Technical Aid to the Disabled, which is an organisation that makes custom designed aids for disabled people in Australia. It's a very interesting work source because you get some really strange ideas from disabled people on exactly what product they want. And of course, often there's no such product around. So you get the parts paid for if it works, which is good. You get very grateful customers. You also get insurance coverage, which is handy. But you don't compete with any actual product in business. Because they'd much prefer that the person go and buy that product if it's available. And so often the products that we make are just economically unviable. No one's going to buy them at the price we made them for and that sort of stuff. At least not without losing money. So, no, I never heard of Skipper. No. Well, yeah, Technical Aid to the Disabled have got sponsorship from Microsoft, so they're mostly Microsoft shop in terms of giving computers out to people. But no, the projects that I did for TAD were all small devices rather than computers. Anyway, I'll go through them quickly. This was a light box. This was for a occupational therapist, hearing expert, I think it was, who had to try and figure out whether a child could actually understand what was being said to them, and the child couldn't talk or anything. So there's these two panels on an A4 page, and a button, big Mac button that the kid would press, and it would be in three states. Either the left-hand panel would be lit, or the right-hand panel, or none at all. And so there's a little PIC microcontroller there, but one of these tiny ones, and a lamp. And the lamp's got a bit hot, so I had to add a fan to it, you know. This pin control arm trigger was for a wheelchair user, quadriplegic, who had a nice control panel around his chin, so he could go and press all the buttons with his mouth or whatever he wanted to use. The problem with that was that he wanted to occasionally talk to people, and it's very difficult to talk when you're like this. So he wanted a way to raise and lower that thing, so it would sort of slide out of the way like that, and down to the side of the chair. And so the PIC in this case had to recognize a certain head movement left and right, which hit micro switches, so nice and easy. So that's what that did. And I learned in this one, do the PCB before buying the box. I ended up having to split the circuit into two just to fit it in. Now, this one was a radio controlled train. Again, these are my early days of PICs. In this case, a garage door opener closer sort of thing, ordinary UHF key fob type transmitter. The kid had this toy train that he loved, but the kid had cerebral palsy and, well, couldn't actually make it go easily. So the first volunteer added a cabled remote, which was a nice big button the kid could press to make it go, off to a cable to the locomotive, which then spun around the kid until the cable ran out and pulled the plug out. Lovely. So we added radio remote control, so we didn't have that problem anymore. So there are two buttons plugged into the orange box on the left, which has no PIC in it, but simply transmits the two button presses. And the two button presses are decoded on the receiver and go into the PIC, and the PIC then runs pulse width modulation speed control of the motor. And that's all battery driven in the tender of the locomotive. Cochlear Implants Centre wanted a way to light up three bays of toys randomly. Sorry? Yes, certainly. It's not meant to be readable. This was a simple pseudo random number generator with a non-crystal clock on it, because they wanted me to avoid a particular frequency that they were using for the implants themselves. So that was an interesting one. This is a fun one. This is where Linux really got involved. It's a speedometer. Notice play. All the brains for the displaying stuff are all done in the laptop computer attached to this. So I've delegated the design. The PIC does all the timing. One plug there connects to the speed sensor, which just gives the pulse per revolution. And the other one is the serial port. And it's even powered from the serial port. And that's down the left-hand side down there, if you want to look at it afterwards. So on the laptop is a cursor program which displays the speed, calculates and does all that sort of stuff, but it's getting its data from the PIC. It's not using the time call in Linux. So it doesn't matter that you get swapped out or something on the 386 I was using. What I learned in this project, though, was the idea of using accurate timing and interrupts and delegating that task so that the timing wasn't the responsibility of the final program. Yes, I was using interrupts on the PIC itself. The interrupt was actually occurring every bit transmission time of the RS-232. So that was handy. I chose that frequency. Pseudo random LED flasher. This just links this LED here. And that's a 24-bit algorithm written in assembler, which just simply does that. It it does the good old X-Law shift from both ends of the bits and brings it in, and then it selects a few bits and pours them, I think, before displaying them. And what's it there for? Why do you need a reason? It just blinks away, and people say, "What's that for?" And I say, "It's blinking." Yeah, it's working. No, I didn't say how I got it random. I explained the X-Law trick with the programmers who would know what I meant. The most successful project I had actually started off as something I needed to do myself. I wanted to connect 4 temperature sensors to a serial port, and so I programmed this thing into a PIC so that it would read the sensors, get the data, and send them down the serial line. But I sort of built it out of my bunch of parts, and there's the bunch of parts. I prototyped it with one of these quartz crystal window things. That's my prototype, and the sensors go on the gold pins down here, and the cable to the computer's up there. And then after I did this prototype, told a few people about it, and the kit maker in Hong Kong said, "Why don't we make a kit of it?" Oh, I don't want to go there, too much trouble. You've got to pay $2,000 to some government bureaucracy to test for EFI and all that sort of stuff. No, I don't want to do it. And he convinced me to send up a prototype. So he did it all. He made the printed circuit board for the project and then started selling the kit. That's the picture of the kit after I built it up. You can see nice DB9 for connection to the serial port. This thing is not big. Here it is here. One chip on it, a few other components, and 4 places to plug in the temperature sensors. There's even a PCB error on that one. This is my production programming environment. Where I would take the chips off from the left-hand side of the picture there, right-hand side, yeah, and plug them into the laptop and program them, and then move them over to my test bed on the left-hand side. Note the use of fencing wire as the anti-static protection. Hey, I'm in the country. There's the attempt to figure out why it wasn't working correctly at the time. So that's where I plugged everyone in. I think I did something like $400 of them, and I got paid $3 each or something by the guy in Hong Kong. So loads of fun. It paid for all the development work I did. And then I said, "Blow this, it's too difficult," and I made it open source. And so I don't get any more money from this one. But I get a lot of people now calling up, writing up, saying, "Oh, it doesn't do this, it doesn't do that." And I say, "Yeah, join the mailing list." Pile of chips. That's what they get when they order the kit. It's a bag of components. Then I met these friends up the road who've got an emu farm, and it took 10 shots to get this photo, really. And it's not gimped, okay? Now they're up in the Warrumbungles. In fact, the little white dot you can see over here is Siding Spring Observatory. So there you are, you know where they are now. These guys farm emus, and you take the fat off the emu and you render it down to an oil and you sell it, and it's something like $20 a bottle of that, it's big or something. $5, that's gone down. There you go. But if you've got 500 emus to kill, but you're not doing the rendering on the farm, you've got to store the fat. So the good old Dodge with a 3-phase converter up there, because he's only got a single phase supply, so he used this as one of the freezers, and then he had to get a few more to fill in. And it's sort of rather expensive. If you're doing all this work for producing emu oil, you don't want to have any freezer failure going unnoticed. And so I convinced him to let me have a bit of a play. Put in a circuit, stuck in the shed, attached to 4 sensors, used the Dataflex 224 2400 board modem to get it from the shed off to the farmhouse. Hey, it works. Well, we didn't want to scratch it. It was good because the device actually talks at 2400 board and gave me lightning protection and all. And then a Cursor's application on the 486 laptop that I was using for it, showing the current temperature on that sensor and what the minimum and maximum were that we saw with a couple of alarm possibilities. They turned the alarm off after a while, it made too much noise. Then they could press the key and show the curves in GNU plot and the outside temperature is the blue line up the top, and that follows the right hand axis, and all the freezes are on the left hand axis, and those big peaks there are when they put in batches of emu fat. That was fun. So, some other projects in 3 minutes. A serial terminal which had an LCD panel on it and a keypad, an RS232. From that one I learned how to do a keyboard matrix scan. There's one of the prototypes, there's another of the prototypes, and there it is running. Okay, it's down there if you'd look at. An irrigation controller, one button to push, and it would rotate between three different solenoid valves to water three different parts of our vegetable patch up at home. I learned that it wouldn't... It was really annoying to have your device reset and go back to the first sprinkler, because that meant the garden got really wet. So I learned how to keep context in the event of a device reset. Memory in the pick is not erased when you reset, which I found really handy, although other people would say that's terrible. That's the device there, just connections for the solenoids. That's the innards of it. A bit tidier than my previous attempts. I actually did the wiring right. My pump controller, this one saved us about $300 in water transport costs. Was it year before last? Last year. It was year before last now. We have this house without any bore nearby, and the well was about 2 kilometres away, and we needed to get water down from it. We didn't have any power up there, so solar power, battery, 12-volt pump. The water in the well was only a foot off the bottom, so we had to wait for it to seep up, and that had happened every couple of days. So I learned a few little tricks with that one. That's the well. That's the controller next to the well. That's one of the prototypes for the controller. The LCD display is just plonked on top of a Domtronics DT106 module into which the pick is plugged. That's over there for you to look at. This shows the wire wrap and the simple components I had to add to interface to the pump and the level switch and all that sort of stuff. My alarm clock, I got sick of my alarm clock. You know how you turn on the alarm clock and it wakes you before you get to bed? Because it's a 12-hour clock. So I wanted a 24-hour clock. I wanted daylight saving adjustment. I wanted my alarm clock to be easy to set. None of this fiddler dial or something, or hold buttons until the value displays what you want. I wanted to be able to just type it in. And I thought, why not stick a serial port on it and a temperature sensor? So that's the innards of it. It's actually down there on the right-hand side. It's got a beeper on it to wake me up, and it wakes me up very quietly. It just goes, beep, beep. And after a while, it doesn't do it more. But anyway, the point is it doesn't wake up the trio. And that was the aim of it. The trio's alarm, however, to wake up anyone. And yeah, I needed the mighty temperature sensor. And all through these projects, I've done something which is sort of open source-ish, in that I kept developing this library of functions. And because I like Forth, I built it like a Forth package would be, where everything's on the stack. When you've only got 41 bytes of memory to deal with, you don't want to waste any of that. And so I allocated 20 of those to my stack and used the rest for other stuff. You can't use a hardware stack on Unix. Well, you can use calling and returning, but you can't actually look at it because it doesn't exist in any addressable memory. And the stack math package continues to be expanded with each project, and yes, it's all open source. All the code for all these kits here is all open source and is on my website. Oh, yeah. It's down a lot of me. Any questions? The pump's a little 12-volt one about that long. We had to bring it up, was it 8 meters? 8 meters out of the well, and then up another couple of meters, and then down 400 meters to the house. So once we got it going, it sucked. Here's how you activate the temperature sensor kit. Set the board rate to 2400 and then cut the thing. It's activated. It's showing the two digits after the decimal place, and if I stick my finger on it, you'll see it zooming up. Is that visible? Oh, good. There you go. I'm not cool. You can actually... The specifications say absolute accuracy within 0.5 degrees. The relative accuracy is about 0.01. Oh, that's once every second. Once every half second. Not fast. You wouldn't use it in industrial process control if it was, had to be fast response. You can use a thermocouple. It's something like 300, 400 milliseconds. Any other desperate questions? Yes. Yeah, you can either get a USB to serial port connector, or there are chips you can get which bring out USB onto lots of physical I/O pins and things. I haven't got into all the Ethernet and running a web server on the PIC and all that. Other people have done that. Yeah? They're not very easy. Yes, Jill? Well, that's an interesting question. Out there, there is a wasp for every size hole. Basically, we didn't leave it long enough to encounter that. But yeah, you seal everything, because otherwise you will get vermin and stuff in the circuit. Yeah, the plastic box had a sort of edge on the side of it, and nothing wanted to get in there. It's too dry for anything to survive at the moment. So. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.